Welcome in, time for KER Politics, thought-provoking views from leaders in the field. The views of our guests do not necessarily represent the views of either Corey or Big Al.
Now, time for KER Politics.
Hey, welcome into our daily editorial. You know, the world, as far as America is concerned, in my opinion, is going to hell in a handbasket. And Jimmy and I are going to talk about that because we think, or I have to say, I think that enough very, very serious things are going on internationally that put the U.S. certainly out of the number one position. The U.S. currency still is considered to be the reserve currency of the world. But look here, Saudi Arabia announced over the weekend that they would take other currencies in payment for their purchases of oil from other countries. What's your comment on that one, Jimmy?
I think there's intense pressure on the dollar as the reserve currency. Part of that is because of inflation. The dollar value has been up for the last year and a half as inflation was rising around the world, and of course as we increased interest rates. The problem is the trust and faith in the stability of the economy, and U.S. leading basically in industry and in military power is diminishing as other countries rise, in particular China. So there's concern. And if the dollar pulls off as the world currency, it will have very big implications on the long-term stability of U.S. Debt. And if we default in debt, and of course, there's an argument this week about the debt ceiling. There's potential catastrophic economic implications.
You bet. I personally think that in terms of raising the debt ceiling, I think it's going to have to happen. Janet Yellen all but came out and said that when she was interviewed late last week and over the weekend. She all but came out and said, you've got to raise the currency because we just don't have, all we can do is print scads of money to pay for the debt. And that's not a good idea because the integrity of the currency will then be diminished quite a bit.
Well, and that's what's happening now, exactly. Why you're seeing a decline over this debt argument. So there's a lot of different pieces going on. The Treasury does have some tools, so it's not an immediate problem. It will be over the next couple months. But what the Freedom Caucus and what some Republicans, a few, are trying to do is rein in the spending.
Yeah.
And that's the most critical element of securing the strength of the dollar and our economy, and that's to stop this crazy spending and this money printing problem.
Well, short-sighted economists would think as the only effective way to stop what's going on in terms of a real serious drop in the integrity of the U.S. dollar. I disagree with that. I think, quite frankly, that if the U.S. came out and said, integrity is what's important to us, and that's what we're going to make that happen, I think that would make us look an awful lot better.
Well, there's a lot of words that go around Washington, a lot of politics, and there's some underhanded efforts out there. And I'll tell you, a lot of the underhanded efforts are coming from globalized countries, globalization from, very powerful institutions and corporations that are trying to buy influence. And of course, behind much of that is the influence of China. And of course, they would love to replace the U.S. dollar with a yuan as a currency, tradable currency. And of course, as we move towards digitization of currency, because many places are, you've got the risk of more control. And of course, this is one of the big topics, one of the key topics out of the Davos World Economic Forum week last week, was moving towards more digital identification and digitalization of currency in their vision as a technocracy that can control people's futures.
Well, I personally think it's going to happen. And going along with that, I really wonder, I always thought that one of the most effective ways to preserve the integrity of a currency was to make it gold-backed. I've studied that subject for a long time, probably 10 to 12 years. I used to speak on it around the world, and I firmly believe today that one of the solutions for increasing the integrity of our currency would be to go back to reverse Nixon's decision you know, which happened when he was in office, that the price of gold was no longer allowed to fluctuate, and it was no longer allowed to act as a guarantee of the U.S. dollar. I mean, that was...
You mean it was allowed to fluctuate because it was locked
in? I look at it a little bit differently. Yes, it was allowed to fluctuate, but the fact of the matter is it was taken out of the position of making the U.S. dollar fully asset-backed. That was...
Right, and I agree. There should be some sort of substantive, tangible commodity-based currency, whether it's gold or some other stable element. It's incredibly important, but at the same time, it should be the value of your economic production, all the factors of your position as an economy to make it stable currency. But so many people are pushing towards globalized currency, with this free exchange and flow with no trading values. It takes away, sovereignty for decision makers,
right.
Takes away sovereignty for the individuals within a country to make decisions about their own future.
Right.
There are economic benefits for, people that are in the EU and the Eurozone to be able to trade easily. That's a value. And everyone in the United States in any state can trade with a dollar. That's important.
Yeah.
But when you begin to control that flow of money and it goes outside of control of your elected officials, which is what we see with the Fed right now, you're risking stability and you're risking bad decisions. And of course, non-responsive to the people that actually suffer the consequences of those bad decisions.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, taking that away from backing the U.S. currency was an incredibly bad decision. It was incredibly short-sighted. I said it then and I'll say it now. Now, the question I have right now is, quite frankly, what effect is that going to have on the price of gold? Well, I read an interesting statistic this morning. The amount of gold that China has taken possession of is absolutely staggering.
Well, that'll be interesting to see if, in fact,
about 20 million ounces.
We'll see what happens with the stability of the currency. Gold prices have been climbing in the last year. We've done pretty well.
Yeah.
There's some people are speculating that it may rise as high as, $3,000 an ounce. We're at about $1,925 an ounce now.
The good old days. I have heard that. Sure.
We'll see what happens. I think there's a lot of factors out there in the world right now. And this is one. I think the war in Ukraine has an impact on all of it. And of course, what's happened in Sweden this weekend has an impact on the war in Ukraine and,
You're talking about the Quran?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, let's hear about that, Jimmy.
Yeah, so this weekend, in front of the Turkish embassy in Stockholm, Sweden, a right-wing Danish guy, Danish-Swedish right-wing party, burned the Quran in front of the Turkish embassy.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's created a big pushback from the Islamic communities and specifically the Turkish government.
Yeah.
And now this is why it's so significant. So Sweden and Finland have applied and have gotten approval from every nation in NATO to join NATO with the exception of Turkey. This event right here was incredibly well orchestrated in order to push Turkey even farther away from approving their entrance into NATO. And of course that benefits the Vladimir Putin. So whether or not he was helping orchestrate this is unknown at this point, but I think it was a brilliant move on his part, if that's in fact what happened, in order to keep the political pressure on against NATO accession for Sweden and Finland.
Jim, now, speaking of NATO, I want to ask you a question because I'm not incredibly well-versed on this issue. Irish came on the blog, I believe it was either last night or this morning, and said it's official, half of NATO no longer approves involvement in Ukraine. Have you heard that?
No, and that's actually, I don't think that's at all accurate.
Yeah.
I'd love to see the evidence of that. I think maybe populations, maybe some of the polling shows that people are not as supportive of it. However, the leadership in NATO and most of the governments are fully on board with it. And of course, we're seeing even more pressure from countries like Poland that are going to donate their German-made Leopard tanks, Leopard 2 tanks, to Ukraine. And this weekend, the German government, which has been under pressure not to support that, went ahead and relinquished their stalling and said, yeah, we'll go ahead and allow that to happen. We're not going to stop that to happen. Yeah, and basically, it's called an end user agreement. And and basically, we do the same thing. Anybody that we donate military equipment to, we have to give permission. The United States has to give, if we sell it or donate it, we have to give permission for them to transfer it to a third party. And that's the same thing that the Germans are doing right now. And of course, they're hesitant to it because they're concerned about what the ramifications would be, potentially a further expanded conflict with Russia. So,
well, that's an interesting point. I think it's just a matter of time before the conflict will involve more than just Ukraine. I mean, of course it does right now. But in terms of some of the combatants that are coming from what I would call offshore, currently supporting Ukraine right now, I think that may change here in the relatively near future, in that I think Russia will make it pretty well known that, come on, Poland, it's none of your business. Come on, America, it's none of your business, et cetera, et cetera. And I would be very interested to see where that particular argument goes. You know, I watched an incredibly interesting interview on BitChute over the weekend dealing with the German situation in terms of German support for Ukraine. And a university professor, a European university professor came out rather strongly and said, I don't think that these countries should support the Ukraine at this point, because that's the quickest way to take the escalation and about quadruple it.
Well, all right. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of propaganda, politics going on this, and there's ideology, and there's people that just won't listen to facts and reality, that they just believe what they want to believe, and they're not going to accept anything else.
Yeah.
But some of these people that are influential, they actually understand the problem, but they're actually voting for the other side, or they're propagandizing for an opposing side, either that be Zelensky or Putin. It's happening on a regular basis.
Yeah.
So most of these discussions, most of this BS that you see is really propaganda with little understanding of what the full complications are. The real serious issues that are underneath are things like what happened this weekend between Estonia and Russia, where the Russians withdrew the Estonian ambassador and the Estonians withdrew the Russian ambassador, kicked them out, and then Latvia joined them as they diminished their diplomatic relationship. So these are NATO countries on the Russian border, very near St. Petersburg, that are becoming more and more conflicted, and they've had a deep, long hatred of Russian influence in the Baltics since World War II and the occupation.
Yeah.
So these are the types of flashpoints and the problems that could make it much more problematic. At the same time, those former Eastern Bloc countries still strongly hate Russian influence. And I'm talking about Poland. I'm talking about Hungary. Hungary, the leadership there has been pretty amenable to Russia.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the population does not want to see what happened in Budapest, back in the 50s.
Right.
The Czech Republic, Slovak Republic. The Slovenians have donated M55 tanks, modified former Soviet tanks or Yugoslav tanks that were built under Soviet license with higher quality optics and range. There's a lot of NATO support for what's happening with the Ukrainians, and that's just a reality and a fact that these countries absolutely do not want Russian influence and expansion onto their territory. And what's happening in Ukraine directly reflects Putin's expansion and influence over Ukrainian territory. They don't want to see any more of that, and they're going to spend whatever they can to stop it. The farther west you move, the more liberal, the more ideologically disconnected they are from that experience of the former Soviet control. So that former Soviet control becomes diminished by leftist ideology that dominates some of those policies and politics in those countries. And that's the reality. That's what's happening.
Of course it's the reality. Jimmy, let's talk about another reality, and that is, it's my understanding that the supply of tanks from America is going to continue, but they are not going to be first-generation tanks. Is that correct?
So they're not. The U.S. is not giving M1 Abrams tanks. The U.S. is donating M2 Bradley fighting vehicles. And these are basically squad-level, you know, three crew members, six infantry soldiers that have a 25-millimeter gun that actually fires a depleted uranium shell. So it's a very potent weapon, and it potentially, you know, penetrates armor of older Soviet equipment. T-72s are actually at risk, as well as their BMPs and BRDMs and that type of equipment. But they, the most important part about them is they're fast, they're maneuverable, they've got very good optics, and they carry TOW missiles, anti-tank missiles that are optically guided by a wire, and they have a very long effective range. And they can outrange many of the Russian tanks. So we're not donating tanks, but we're donating armored vehicles that have an anti-tank capability, as well as a large amount of anti-tank handheld weapons, which are devastating for ambushes, which is why you saw the Russians having to pull out from their advance on Kiev early on in the fight. What you're also seeing, though, with this movement from the Poles to offer up T-72 tanks, and the French to offer up their AMX wheeled tanks, they've got a good-sized gun on them. These are the reason why they're threatening to the Russians is because they have more sophisticated optics that are that work better under adverse conditions, under bad weather, and they have better stabilizers. They're more reliable to some extent. They take a lot of maintenance, but they're more reliable, and they have a longer range than the Russian Soviet, former Soviet style equipment, even the modified new Russian versions of their tanks. They have, and that's been proven in every single conflict where it's you know, Western weapon systems have gone up against Russian systems. So it's going to be a bit of a challenge to get them in theater for the Ukrainians. It's going to be an incredible challenge to maintain them and equip, you know, keep them operating, because they'll have a wide variety of different weapon systems, and that means maintenance and technical support. But at the same time, you know, most of these countries are still pouring money into them, and the U.S. is as well. I mean, if the NATO countries led by the United States really wanted a negotiated settlement, they'd say, hey, we're going to stop giving Ukraine weapons and equipment. The Ukrainians would have to negotiate. Yeah. At the same time, the Russians aren't really going to stop. They're going to take that opportunity to push their objectives and their agenda.
You bet. And the time couldn't be more unfortunate for the United States. I mean, now that we know exactly what the U.S. debt is, it's absolutely a staggeringly large number. And to have to allot a significant portion of its money now into the Ukraine makes it incredibly difficult to do that. It's gotten to the point where it has meaningfully affected our country.
Absolutely. And, you know, just to spend this money and to – okay, so I had a young officer over from – dinner last night, former 82nd Airborne officer and field artillery. And in that discussion, talking about the MLRS, it's just left Korea not long ago. They had scheduled for brand new MLRS systems to come into Korea, and they actually diverted those to Ukraine and gave them older ones, gave U.S. forces in Korea older ones. In other words, saying, you're going to die. You're not going to, you know, if the North Koreans invade, you're going to die, and we're going to give these to the Ukrainians. So there's frustration at the operational level and the tactical level with U.S. military officers on the sustainment of our own forces as we pour money into the Ukrainians. And it's actually getting it's having an impact. We can't produce the ammunition. We can't produce the weapon systems for our own defense needs. Whether you agree with them or not, that becomes very risky if, in fact, We have expanded conflicts in Taiwan, North Korea, or in other regions that are unknown and unseen of today because of all this destabilization around the world from these crazy economic policies and bad foreign policy decisions.
Well, I got to tell you, Jimmy, if China really wants seriously to get Taiwan back, I can't think of a better time right now. I can't think of a better time than now to do it. The United States is, I would have to say, somewhat disorganized, and number two, I would have to say, somewhat unable to fund two theaters of operation, one being Ukraine and another very serious one being in Taiwan. And it's only a matter of time before the Chinese decide to pull a trigger on that one.
Yeah, I agree. I think that at some point they've made it very clear they're one country, they're going to reunify. That's according to Beijing. Taiwan is saying, and Taipei is saying, no, we're not going to do that. Now, 28 million to 1.4 billion, it's a tough fight. The likelihood of being successful and defending against that, it'd make it really tough, but it's probably impossible without external support. If the United States is unable or unwilling to support the Taiwan government, that Beijing's going to say, okay, it's time to move, and they'll just take that opportunity. That would cause catastrophic consequences around the world, both economically, but also loss of life and damage. But this is the problem in the situation we're in when we have a weak leadership and very weak government that fails to understand the dynamics of these global decisions. And actually is probably in the background, and we know from cooperation with the Chinese and the Biden family, there may be compromised in making decisions that are directly against U.S. interests in order to fund their own finances and their own, you know, enrich themselves.
Yeah, I mean, the circumstances are such right now that the United States may be the most powerful country in the world, but it's not. It isn't split up in a way right now that's effective. Two major theaters of operation, one basically supported by Russia and the other one supported by mainland China. It just ain't the time for us to do that. I think it's impossible personally, Jimmy.
Well, I think at this point it would be very improbable. I don't know about impossible. You know, people do rally when it comes to some of these things. I just don't think, like the Ukrainian war, like many of these problems, we should have ever have gotten here.
Oh, I agree.
I go right back to 9/11.
Yeah.
Prior to 9/11, Bill Clinton, as president, had the opportunity to stop bin Laden in a classified operation and a mission. He failed to do it. It ended up in destroying the coal, killing a lot of American sailors, and then we ended up having, you know, the 9/11 attacks that created absolute catastrophic war throughout the regions of the world.
Yeah.
And that, unfortunately, these are things that we could avoid with a better foresight and willingness to do what's, you know, actually take action when necessary, at the very minimum, but in every possible case you can, use diplomacy to avoid conflict.
Yeah, we very definitely did not take action when we had the ability to do that. Jimmy, we're up to about 25 minutes. You have anything else you want to say, or you want to leave it for next time?
I think we better leave it to next time. We did want to talk about the Wall Street Journal articles on the bivalent boosters and
I'll go ahead and describe them real quick. I'm gonna source them and post them on the website.
Sure. So Wall Street Journal came out with an article, using a couple of studies that have been published in the New England Journal of Medicine, basically outlining the fact that the new boosters do nothing, and that the FDA and the CDC have been propagandizing and still continuing to argue and publicly post information that says they are beneficial when in fact the information shows there isn't. Even NPR is questioning. National Public Radio, in an extensive article, is talking about the FDA changing direction with their booster policies and turning it into an annual shot, which again is a corrupt method to support the pharmaceutical industry, in my view. But even they are coming about and saying, hey, look, information is showing that, in fact, the boosters don't do anything for you. In fact, may make it more risky.
A whole bunch of credibility, in my opinion. But given the subject matter, I would bet my money on the New England Journal of Medicine. And I'm going to source those articles and post them on the website. Jim, great talking to you. Thanks, man.
All right, Al. We'll talk to you later.
To find out more about today's guest, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com.